for Midweek Media Watch. Kia ora, Colin.
Kia ora, Karen.
So you've got a big show tonight and a few bit of backtracking, I think.
I have, but first of all, I do want to assure you that Emil can stay up late. I mean, he stayed awake for the entire Football World Cup to do that podcast. I think he had about 2 power naps somewhere in between the quarterfinals and the final, but otherwise he stayed awake basically for 4 straight weeks. He can do it.
A child of the 2000s. Goodness me.
He's got the stamina.
Good. That's excellent. All right, so what have you been doing? A few typos, I believe.
Yeah, afraid so. And I got caught out for this, but basically I got a bit of a social media lesson and engagement. Because every weekend on Media Watch, we have 3 or 4 topics in the program. We tweet them out as individual stories with a bit of web copy to read there for people to share online. And on Sunday, as the program's going out on air, I do this and then just have a look to see if these are being retweeted or liked or shared. And last weekend, the stories were fairly hefty ones. You know, the Herald's paywall, press freedom in New Zealand, bit of a comment on political journalism. They didn't really get much traction. But as I was doing this, I took a look at a profile of Mike McRoberts, all about him turning into a 50-plus sex symbol because of Dancing with the Stars. Quite an engagingly written piece, but right in the middle of the piece, out of nowhere, the word McSpunk in capital letters suddenly appeared. So I took a little screenshot.
McSpunk.
McSpunk. So I'll read you the sentence. So this is as it appeared on the Stuff site. McRoberts was raised in Christchurch, the eldest of 4 children, born to teen parents. He is Ngāti Kahununu, but grew up feeling a bit McSpunk, disconnected from his culture and so on. So this word just completely dropped in there. And this, of course, was the tweet that took off. And I suppose going viral is a bit strong, but it got shared a lot more than any of our more serious content. But I did get kind of taken to task by one of the retweeters who said, look, pointing out people's slip-ups is something that Media Watch does, but look at this piece, which is one of the ones I tweeted that morning. I stopped reading after 5 typos, and I went in, and sure enough, there were 3 that I spotted and corrected straight away. And this was in a piece that was all about premium journalism in the Herald. So,
rushing.
Yeah, this is a bit like, what do they say, like, there, but for the grace of God, do you go if you throw black pot and kettle in your glass house, or whatever the saying is, you know.
That's a mishmash, but yep, we know what you mean.
Yeah.
But why McSpunk?
Well, this was because it was all about Mike McRoberts.
I know what it was about, but how did it get in the story? Well, I think McSpunk in it?
I think they picked on this as a caption because the first line of the story had, you know, some of the words being the new tags being banded around for the new hot 50-plus Mike McRoberts with his bare oily chest and his Dancing with the Stars outfit. So I think that's what it was, possibly a caption item or tag or something like that that somehow got dumped and pasted by mistake in the text that went online. And Tim Murphy of the Newsroom website made an interesting point about this, because the story was an interesting one. It was well written, but all about a guy who's completely been celebrified. And Tim Murphy said, you know, interesting that you've got News Hub, TV3, as was, basically, you know, that they've put out their top newsreader as bare chest and dancing, while Simon Dallow of TVNZ is currently on bus stop ads for his employers, all about his background as a lawyer before going to journalism, messages of trust and facts and so on. So an interesting contrast right now he spotted in how our network newsreaders are being seen.
Which one do you believe?
I don't know, but it just means I can get the discussion away from the typos I made, the mistakes I made that were picked up on social media, having highlighted and having some fun at that's at the expense of someone else. So
how are you going to fix your typos from here on? And are you going to go to Grammarly?
No, I'd never do that. That looks. I'm sure that would actually probably mangle your writing even worse. But what we do is Jeremy Rose, my colleague, he looks over my stuff. I look over his. But that one wasn't his fault. I've got to take the blame for that because I wrote it rather late in the piece that morning and didn't give it enough due care and attention. Yeah, and it was about premium journalism. So, yeah, not a good look to have a series of typos picked up by another keen-eyed social media watcher.
Now, John Campbell, he's been on the agenda for a few weeks, hasn't he?
Yeah, we talked about him last time I was with you for the Midweek Media Watch. And, we talked a bit about it and came to the conclusion, as I think a lot of critics did, that it was an odd career move and not a particularly good fit for John Campbell and his style of journalism. So it's probably only fair to say that now he's actually started on the program, because we were speaking just as the move was imminent, that he has actually introduced a bit of heftier journalism to the program, which is sort of an odd fit. And Hayden Donnell, the commentator writing for Stuff website, reviewing John Campbell's first week on the show, he said maybe the critics have got it the wrong way around. It's not that morning TV is a waste of Campbell's journalistic talents. It's that the 7 p.m. time slot he was previously on was a waste of his talents as a showman, and says he's rather enjoyed watching John Campbell wander around the set, interrupting his colleagues and goofing around and having a good time in that sort of early morning banter mood that they have on The Breakfast Show. And if it's true that this generally lightweight format of The Breakfast Show hasn't stopped him tackling some big issues, then that's good. So on his first day, for example, he had an 11-minute long feature, which is available online. And if you go to the Media Watch page of the RNZ website, I've put some links to this so you can see it for yourself if you're interested. A big long piece on homelessness in Auckland. They set up a little bed that outside the City Mission, which, as he pointed out, was just up the road from the studios of TVNZ, and indeed RNZ studio right across the road from you there where you're broadcasting from, and did a very long piece and said we will be returning to the topic of homelessness, poverty in Auckland. And yesterday, he led the bulletins with another story, a story he's been following for years, which was the subprime response of insurers of people in Christchurch after the quakes, and the news that a class action lawsuit being launched with Australian backing against the government-owned insurer Southern Response. So that then led the bulletins on RNZ. Other media followed it up. So a good scoop there. And TVNZ really made the most of it, putting it online with John Campbell's face all over it and a background about the surveillance that Southern Response presided over with the Thompson Clark private investigation firm as well, a story that all links into that. So if they seem to be determined, I think, to show that having put John Campbell on The Breakfast Show, it doesn't mean they're all going light and fluffy and not giving him room to do some of those serious stories that he's been pursuing for years.
And he's not the only person who's been moved around, or moved themselves around, should I say.
Yep, but a bit of movement in the morning, isn't there, right?
Yes.
Now? Yeah.
Sorry, I won't comment on that. Carry on.
Well, Guyon Espiner has shifted from Morning Report. So he had a kind of emotional last run, and after 5 years in the program that went quite quickly, some nice farewells to him, and he's now been replaced by Corin Dann. So both of those guys have been former political editors at TVNZ, and I guess Corin can slot in there alongside Susie Ferguson as the other main host, and the Morning Report program will carry on a lot like it has been in the past. But there's a whole new program launched this week to feed more listeners into Morning Report. That's the idea. So this new news show from 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. on RNZ National called First Up. And quite a bit of focus on the host for that one, who is Indira Stewart, a relatively new broadcaster and new name to people, but I guess fairly well known to you and your colleagues in the RNZ newsroom in Auckland. And I'm sort of a bit torn about this because, you know, to me, it shouldn't matter too much who the hosts are, and there should be a range of people who could slot in and fill these roles. And it should be, you know, the program itself, the team and the broadcaster, RNZ in this case, that gives these news programs their power. Not too much should hinge on the actual person who's fronting it. But Indira is interesting because, as has been pointed out, she becomes the first ever Pacific presenter of a regular weekday show on RNZ's national network in its entire history. Her background is a Tongan Fijian. Her father's from Tonga, her mother from Kadavu in Fiji, and she herself born in Tonga and says raised a bit more on her Tongan side. But this really is a bit of a first for New Zealand broadcasting.
Which is great and long overdue.
Well, that's the thing. And the interesting part of the story she told in the most detail to E Tangata, which, if people aren't familiar with it, it's an online forum of Māori and Pacifica journalism, and some long extended pieces on there. People can go into a bit of depth. They initially build it as a kind of Sunday magazine online for people interested in these issues. And she did quite a long piece there with Dale Husband, Māori broadcaster of some experience and standing, and she said that actually John Campbell had given her quite a bit of advice, saying don't try and be Susie Ferguson, don't try and be Kim Hill. We have people like that. John Campbell said we need you to be you, and just be Indira Stewart. But she said, interestingly, she was shoulder tapped for this role by Pip Keane, the news editor up in RNZ in Auckland, and the head of multimedia journalism there. And she said, look, I had to pinch myself that RNZ had picked me, a brown woman, to front one of their news programmes. It never would have occurred to me that this would be on the cards. I never thought to apply for the job. It just didn't occur to me that this was an appointment they'd make, which is quite a stark thing to say. And she went on to say to Itangata in Dale Husband's interview, I'm going into this first show knowing that some brown girl, Māori or Pākehā, might be listening or watching and when we go on multimedia and might think, look, I'll do that one day when I get older. And she said that would make it all worthwhile for me because I never had that experience. So, you know, while I sit here saying, look, it shouldn't matter too much who the host is, the programme should be the programme and should have a power of its own and be supported by the broadcaster, no matter whose voice or face is doing the presentation. I mean, in this case, I suppose it really does make a difference, doesn't it?
Absolutely, given RNZ's charter and its requirement to be multicultural.
Indeed, and indeed there are moves that have still yet to be made in Māori broadcasting by RNZ. If you think, for example, that Willie Jackson criticised the broadcaster heavily, pretty much kickstarting RNZ into taking some action and launching a strategy, a revised strategy for this. I mean, Guy and Espen are now gone from Morning Report. He introduced bits of Te Reo into the presentation, which became, you know, a bit of an issue when Don Brash got involved with that. But it did kickstart debate about that. But Te Reo Broadcasting or programs in Te Reo at RNZ, they disappeared years ago, haven't reappeared. So there are plans to reintroduce some content, but as yet we don't know what those are. So in terms of issues beyond just presentation and so on, there's a bit to change there. But RNZ does have a more diverse crop of journalists, particularly younger journalists from different backgrounds now than it has in the past. So, you know, you would hope that these things change because, as I said, you know, it's not necessarily all about you know, who's presenting the shows. It's also about who's making editorial decisions and doing the journalism. And actually, that did come up in the same Dale Husband interview, because Dale said, look, I listen to RNZ quite a lot and I've noticed a number of Pacific stories that are quite powerful. And he said to Indira, I suspect you're behind some of those without me knowing. And she said, well, yeah, that's a hard one. Every story is meaningful to me, she said. As a journalist, it's a privilege to provide a platform for someone else to have a voice. And there is a matter-of-fact element to this work. You file a story, you go home. But there's also the sense of giving someone an opportunity, someone who's been voiceless can be heard. That's the best part of being a Pacific journalist. So she herself is acknowledging that, you know, being part of the team, feeding into the journalism is important. And that, I hope, would happen no matter who has been picked to present the programmes.
And I see Mahinarangi Forbes had something to say as well.
Yeah, that was in response to people saying, well, you know, haere rā Guyan, and thank you for your contribution in making Te Reo more visible and on Morning Report and starting more debate about that. It's been great to hear, so someone said on social media. And Mihinarangi Forbes went and replied, said, look, bro, do you know how many times I've applied to Radio New Zealand for so-called marquee roles? I would respectfully have shared my te reo with all of you as well. So, of course, she left as she was Māori issues correspondent here at RNZ for a time, has left. She's now on the Hui on TV3, and she was made a guest appearance, if you could call it that, for the Waitangi Day broadcast. I was the Wellington end of that, and it was great to be able to be on air with her again. So a pointed comment there saying that actually it's not for want of trying that people haven't tried to take those roles and be more visible as Māori hosts on RNZ.
Well, Colin, what did you think of the First Up show?
Well, early days for the program, but what's interesting is if the program is billed as feeding more listeners into Morning Report, particularly in the Auckland region. That's part of the mission for the First Up show. So those early risers, people have a long commute into Auckland. They're hoping those will be key listeners. They also wanted to create news that could then be taken up by the rest of RNZ's news programs, feed into the news agenda, and sort of standalone video features that could be shared and used as audio and radio broadcasts as well. So on day one, they opened up with a kind of exclusive and quite long and emotional interview with Juanita Hickey, who was the mother of two teenage boys who were killed in a triple fatality, a car crash, while they were fleeing police in January. You might remember the pictures were absolutely horrific of the burned out car. And Juanita told the tale to them of asking health workers and cops for help and saying that she felt that she kind of wasn't taken seriously. And we'll just play you now a little bit that will give you a sense of what that sounded like if you were to hear it on the air.
They were great kids. They both had big hearts, huge hearts, very, very close, the two of them. They were always right next to each other. Glenn was always the protector of Craig. I did a lot of voluntary work right from when Craig was 8. He was right by my side. We'd be clearing properties, cleaning up people's yards that were disabled, things like that, which also led.
Well, that's very, very sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is sad. But, I mean, you see the treatment there. It's quite TV-style, close-up camera, the piano soundtrack there, which...
Oh, I wasn't even listening to that. But, yes, it did have a soundtrack to it, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite to my taste. But it actually took me back to the very first day of Checkpoint with John Campbell, when that was RNZ's first multimedia InVision production. They had a long interview with Nadine Lomu, Jonah Lomu's widow. Similarly sad, long interview. But, you know, that was only part of the story about his squandered legacy. And I have feelings about this too, that this was only part of a bigger story, you know, told at great length by Juanita herself. Gavin Ellis on the 9 to Noon program, the media commentator, former Herald editor, he said this was great. He thought it was a good investigative piece and praised it. But I felt differently. Juanita was saying that she'd talked to, you know, health agencies in Christchurch and the police, failed to get much of a response. I wasn't listened to, and that she knew that these kids were stealing cars and that there was a problem here. This was something that could have been predicted or prevented. But where we were given the sense of a case falling through the cracks, or that some people perhaps hadn't done their job, or that maybe inadequate resourcing and staffing was part of the issue. But it wasn't clear to me whether the response of the police and the DHBs, who said they couldn't comment for, in the police case, there's an investigation ongoing, they say, they won't comment, and the DHB in Canterbury saying, look, we cite privacy concerns, and they just left it there. That was the reason they wouldn't comment. But is this reasonable? Is it normal? I don't know. The program didn't tell us that. So I felt that we were given a fairly emotional account there, beefed up with a bit of, you know, a sad soundtrack and so on, but this was really only part of the story of what happened. It hinted at the case not being handled properly, and there's something could have been done to prevent this, but I'm not sure what it is, and I don't think they quite got that far. So, I mean, I would hope they would go back to this, and, you know, you're also wondering, well, is there an inquest? What did it find? Is it still to be held? I think there were too many unanswered questions, and that basing it all around an emotional interview like that doesn't actually help people get a picture of a full story.
When you say long, how long was it?
More than 10 minutes. And there was another person interviewed, well, the older sister of two of the boys as well. And look, there's another aspect to this, which is a bit unfortunate, was that Juanita Hickey, the name and the face, might mean something to people who remember that story, because days afterwards she was in the news because she performed a kind of burnout in the street in tribute, and this was put on social media. The rest of the news media then were asking the police, are you going to charge her for this? They thought this was a fairly disgraceful act, considering there was also another kid, a friend of theirs, who died in this crash, and that she was doing this extraordinary, you know, burnout in the street in tribute. Some people thought this was really tasteless. Now, I don't know how people react in grief or what she was hoping to achieve with that. It certainly got the media's attention. But people did ask questions at the time. You look at the online comments, people saying, well, what kind of culture did these boys grow up in? Now, the First Up program didn't dwell on that at all. I mean, maybe that's the right thing, because you don't want to attack people for how they respond in grief. But, you know, to me, there are questions about if the mother is saying, I don't think that enough was done to prevent this tragedy happening, and I tried to flag up that there were problems. I'm really not sure whether others, including herself, had done enough, and whether the program, you know, really answered the questions I have about that particular case.
Early days.
Yeah, and there's other things they're doing too. They want to say, they want to get out and do stories from regional New Zealand, which is good, because it's an undercovered aspect of our media. And also that they want to do stories about the people who are up and about at 5 a.m., which is a nice idea. But the day one, they had a guy working at Auckland Zoo, getting the food ready for the animals and so on. Ellie J went out to do that in a video online. I don't think we really need more stories from Auckland Zoo, which is a fairly well-covered outfit with its own PR team and so on, and it's Auckland. I would rather, and I hope they will, get their journalists out and about, use RNZ's regional journalists and gather more content from around the country and put that on the program.
And a good time, too, to be talking internationally as well because of the time differences. It's a great time at that 5 o'clock hour.
Yeah, and that's another goal of theirs, is what happened while you were sleeping. And a lot of that will be, of course, overseas news. And that fits the pattern of other programs on other talk stations that are on air between 5 and 6, where they have business news because the business people are up early and watching the markets and so on and reflecting what's gone on overseas and talking often to foreign correspondents overseas who can bring people up to date with what's been going on, especially in the States and UK and so on, overnight. So there might be a bit of that too. But the original content is definitely, they're being more ambitious than just that. You know, they want to create this original content, and it's a big effort to go out and get those stories. There's one that's a bit of a hit online today. Disabled man Andrew Oliver in a farm in Waikato, the Fonterra tanker drivers have changed their routes because he loves welcoming the tankers. And it's kind of a real feel-good story that they've put out online. It's going gangbusters on Facebook by the look of it. Interesting that when I looked at it, I thought, this does make Fonterra look like a very generous company. And I did wonder about some sort of PR involvement. On the journalists' Facebook group, this question was actually raised, and the producer of the program, Jeremy Parkinson, said, oh no, this is a story Indira's been looking at for a couple of years. She's known about this guy, gone out and filmed it. And another journalist replied to him saying, oh, that's good, because I'd assumed it had come from Fonterra comms and PR. And Jeremy, the producer, said, oh no, nothing like that. So that's really good. But interesting that the RNZ Facebook followers, when they commented on the story on RNZ's Facebook page, some of them did think, this was a PR story. In fact, one here says, a PR dream story for Fonterra. Public radio is serving the business interests of a mega corporation. Will Richie McCaw now pay him a visit? What's wrong with this picture? So some people did see the hand of Fonterra, and that we're assured, I guess, from those Facebook comments, that's not the case. But interesting that most of the journalists who responded to it thought it was just a really nice feel-good story, a beautiful grassroots tale, a guy who's disabled being portrayed in this way, a story that can be shared online. And they welcomed it. So it was actually the cynicism coming not from the journalists, but from the RNZ Facebook followers, interestingly.
And New Zealand Music Month, you promised you're going to talk about a bit of music.
Yeah, well, there's lots and lots. And do go to the webpage and have a look at this, because I've got links to all of this. But I think it's a bit of a festival for Kiwi music nostalgics right now. Particularly those of a certain age, perhaps, or I'm going to talk about perhaps my age, but people who are around in the 80s, unlike Emile Donovan, who's about 20 years too late for it. But there's currently Anthems, the series running on Prime TV, publicly funded by New Zealand On Air, so 6 episodes about anthemic, supposedly iconic Kiwi hit songs to tell the stories behind those. There's the Chills documentary, and I think Julia Parnell, the producer who's made that, filmed at the Triumph and Tragedy of Martin Phillips, the story of the Chills. She also had a role in the Anthems program. And I wasn't sure how much. I watched an episode and a half of Anthems. There's more to come that haven't aired yet. To me, that wasn't awfully compelling, having, you know, ex-members of the Dudes talking about how they made Bliss and the stories. It just wasn't that great. But this, I haven't seen the Chills documentary. It's in the movies now, but from what I've heard about it, it does sound like a more interesting film. And I've always thought the Chills music doesn't appeal to me, and I've always found, you know, this apparent intensity and of Martin Phillips himself like a bit off-putting. But the producer of the film, Julia Parnell, and Martin Phillips himself, they went on Newstalk ZB's Sunday Session show, and Martin Phillips talked about being a bit surprised to find that people think he's a bit staid and doer.
I've been surprised to learn how much people didn't realise I was fine. I'm always kidding around, and I was surprised to learn that I was seen as a very sort of dry, boring character. You know?
It was a pretty cathartic exercise making this movie, wasn't it, Martin?
It has been, and personally it's meant actually communicating with band members I haven't spoken to or really connected with for nearly a quarter of a century in some cases.
Well, that's difficult when, you know, you have an interview with there's so many members of the Chills and so many of them have got a story to tell about Martin.
Yeah, indeed. And just in the trailer, there are one or two who have sort of almost shell-shocked looks on their faces saying, I haven't heard from him since the day he booted me out of the band or whatever. So if there has been a reconciliation, I suppose that's great. It put me in mind of there's a brilliant documentary which you can find online. John Peel made it for the BBC about Captain Beefheart. And there's a guy who was in his magic band back in the 60s talking about how horrible it was working for such a taskmaster. And this was in the late 60s. And he said in all seriousness, or no hint of a flicker of irony on his face, that he wished he'd actually been in Vietnam rather than in the magic band with Captain Beefheart. So kind of rang a bell with me.
And Shane Carter, he was on Kim Hill on Saturday.
Yep. So he's done a memoir called Dead People I Have Known?
It is.
Yep, and great interview. Oh, the full hour with Kim Hill with music interspersed into it. And this is a really good personal story because all the intense stuff about the music and how it was made and bands falling apart, it leaves me a little bit cold. But Shane Carter said he wanted to tell a different story, and I've actually flipped through Kim's copy without asking, actually. It's on the bookshelf in the office that we share, so hope she's not listening. But I did thumb through it when she wasn't using the book. And he can really write really well, and he wanted to write about his family, about growing up in Dunedin at a certain time. And he actually told Kim Hill that he just isn't interested in writing about all that rock and roll history stuff anymore.
A lot of the later musical stuff, you know, I've talked about that billions of times. So.
Yeah, sick to death of talking
I'm actually really sick of talking about She Speeds. Yeah. I'm sick of talking about Andrew leaving the straitjacket fits.
Wasn't going to mention it.
And all that kind of, I'm sure you weren't.
Oh dear, I can understand where he's coming from. He's a very smart man, Shane Carter.
Yeah, I just love that. I'm not interested in talking about all that stuff. And that probably is what he gets asked about all the time, even 20 years on. But no, he's gone far further and produced what looks like a pretty interesting book. And he claims he's the reliable witness too, because that's always always a bit of an open question. And another memoir-style effort has just come out recently. This is Jan Helrigal, formerly a Dunedin singer-songwriter, I think in Auckland these days. And she's done a memoir called Sportsman of the Year. And it's a music, it's an album, it's a book as well, and also a podcast series by RNZ. It's really great. And she too has a really great sense of perspective in that, she almost made it, got invited to these big music showcases, had the possible opportunity to make it big, and it just didn't work out. And in fact, in an episode called Neptune, which I thoroughly recommend, it's on the RNZ website, she talked about the day she was up for one of these big gigs, could have been a big breakthrough with the agents watching. Her dog died, she was dumped by her partner, and the whole gig turned to custard.
There are moments in showbiz when you realise you've lost your audience. It's when eye contact disappears and the energy they were sending your way starts to fragment and dilute. Everyone starts turning away, talking to their neighbour, squirming uncomfortably in a chair and looking anywhere as long as it isn't at you. This really wasn't the day to be having one of those moments. When we were finished, all we got was a smattering of mild, polite, sad applause, and that was it. We were done, like really done. Or as Wayne Bell said in a book about rock and roll touring stories. And that was the end of Jan in Australia.
I look forward to reading that book, but I don't know why it's called Sportsman of the Year.
Oh, that's, I think, a title she was robbed of at primary school when she deserved it, went to a boy and it should have been her. Long-standing grievance.
Thank you very much, Colin. We're just coming up to 11 o'clock, so thanks for that. And I'll be back in June.
Excellent. Well, they say it's a well-deserved break. Everyone has to say have a well-deserved break. But, yeah, I'll go along with the meal and assume that it is well-deserved.
Thanks. That's Colin Peacock.